Coming up next, an interview with Marjorie Kowalski-Cole, author of a new political novel called Correcting the Landscape. Marjorie Kowalski-Cole's debut novel, Correcting the Landscape, won the Bellwether Prize for Fiction, which was endowed by Barbara Kingsolver. The book is about an Alaskan newspaper editor, Gus Trainer, who struggles to save his paper from going under financially, but finds it difficult to balance the editorial pages against advertising revenues. It's also a love story, not just between the characters, but between the characters and the landscape. Marjorie, welcome to KABU. You know, the book takes place 3 years after the Exxon Valdez disaster, and one of the big events in the novel occurs when a stand of trees just outside of Fairbanks is cut down. These sort of ecological issues figure prominently in the book. Did you set out to put them in there front and center, or did they are they just so much a part of everyday life in Alaska that you couldn't leave them out?
The second. They are so much a part of everyday life in Alaska. I've lived there since 1966, and there have been periods where the landscape has just changed drastically, even though the population is still fairly small. And it becomes more and more, you know, a global problem. I understand that about the forest. The forest cover worldwide is threatened and very important. So there's a connection between what's happening in Alaska and what's happening globally. But it's real clear in Alaska. It's real part of daily life.
So you see this on a day-to-day basis?
Oh, sure. I sure do, yeah. In fact, that opening scene with the trees being slashed did happen to someone very dear to me, and that was a very interesting experience. I feel that the forest cover, you know, is precious in so many ways, but one way is that it shields us from ourselves. We need a place to provide shade and mystery in our lives, and to lose ourselves, to just get away from ourselves for a while. Human beings really need that, and when the forest goes, for the sake of open land, for development, you really lose a lot more than just a few trees.
One of the characters in the beginning of the book, it's Tad, who bulldozes down the trees, and that whole issue becomes part of Gus's dilemma. By the end of the book, Tad regrets the destruction. And do you see this sort of ecological epiphany happening in Alaska today, or do you think people who think of the landscape as indestructible generally remain adamant about their right to just bulldoze down the trees?
Boy, that's a good question. I think that in Alaska, quite a few people who are, as you put it, adamant about their right to do what they want also have moments when they are out in the wilderness hunting or fishing or gardening or landscaping their own property, where they're so happy to be in Alaska. They love what's around them. But as you said, there is a strong sense that it's endless. Now, to me, it's not endless. You know, so many things are gone for good that were once just inexhaustible. You know, just to take some animals, for example, the passenger pigeon and the buffalo. Great forests in the Midwest, great forests here, we're not in Washington State, but up in Washington State, where I lived till I was 13, getting cut down. Well, John Haynes is a poet, great American poet, who wrote, "Forests precede civilization and deserts follow." And that's happened. And then I went to Ireland in 1992, and for the first time, and been back several times since, and it's so beautiful there. It's lovely. It's a great place. So I was quite surprised to discover that actually Ireland was once densely forested with huge oak forests. And it's basically treeless now. There's no forest cover in Ireland at all. The trees are decorative.
Yeah. I was in Wales in 2004, and one of the sheep farmers had a house that dated from, I think, the 1400s. It was very old, this little stone cottage. And one of the beams in the house was this enormous oak beam. And he said, well, yeah, it was from a tree that grew around here. And, you know, you get an idea of the old growth forests that they had there. And, of course, now the place is basically treeless.
Yes, that's right.
So we're just kind of importing that sort of destruction.
Well put. That's what I'm afraid is gradually happening. Yeah.
Now, one of the characters talks about her time living in a traditional village.
Mm-hmm.
Are there many people living in this way? And do you think that this is having any effect on the way resources are used in Alaska?
Alaska is a population, an Alaska Native population, about 15% of the state is in the villages. The villages are all different one from another, but they're in roadless areas. They live on rivers. And I haven't been to enough of the villages to really to answer that question. I think the adherence to traditional ways varies from village to village. I know that it's still quite seasonal out in the villages in a very wonderful way, certain activities for certain times of the year. And so there's quite a bit of that. At the same time, you know, there's a lot of contemporary problems have hit the villages with. So it varies from village to village.
But it sounds like overall, kind of that whole viewpoint isn't really having a big impact on the way people view the resources or how they're being used.
I feel it's a quiet, low-key understanding of the forest, and that quiet, low-key understanding of, well, I say of the forest, but of course there's a lot of villages that aren't in forest. They're in different types of landscape. But that understanding is not getting translated to the decision makers, and a lot of it is kind of locked or hidden inside the native languages, which are still spoken in Alaska. And I agree with you. It's not getting translated into decisions.
The main character, Gus, is kind of pressured to downplay the story behind the destruction of the forest, and he spends a lot of time thinking about the ethics of reporting. What kind of got you interested in that aspect of the story?
Just observing the way events that I knew something about or was curious about were played in the media, the way they played in the media, in the newspapers, in
Alaska. Can you give me an example?
Most recent example, one that's, you know, really painful for all of us, really, is what's happened in the country since 9/11. The after 9/11, you know, like so many, I was so shocked and horrified and scared, and so I listened to the radio a lot and read a lot, and the voices, the human voices and the writers trying to make sense of this were such a comfort to me, very important. So I thought, well, maybe this analysis and discussion and writing will save us from rash decisions. But then I started to notice, like a lot of people did, that the reporters began to back off, that there was a lack of follow-up. And the slant that was put on news events officially was accepted. When that alternative comment and dialogue stops and the official story is allowed to become the story, that's a little frightening. Now, that's a big issue affecting the whole country. So is global warming. There's a lot of debate on global warming in Alaska. Locally, there's the usual scene. Some of them, actually, this novel has a few episodes from actual recent Fairbanks history. One is the story of the challenged library book. So there's a book that's challenged at the local library. It becomes a little controversy within the community, tears the community apart because it's a people are arguing about whether this book is appropriate for children, and they basically don't understand the story or read the story.
Right. I thought it was funny that so many of the people who were opposing the book had only seen one little piece of it, and that was enough for them to condemn the whole book.
That's right.
It's like nothing's put in context.
Right. The fact that the hero of the book himself works against what is portrayed in that scene is lost on them. They didn't get that far.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, you were going to read a poem that actually was from one of my favorite characters. He's Felix, this Irish poet who inspires Gus to act in a way that can either be seen as an act of vandalism or correcting the landscape, the way you have in the title. Do you want to read that?
Sure. Sure. Felix is wandering through Alaska. This book takes place in the very early 90s, before the Celtic Tiger transformed Ireland's economy. So in those days, Felix was still one of the young Irishmen leaving Ireland to find work. But he also likes to write poetry. So this poem is called Correcting the Landscape by Felix Heaven. Down to the waterfront at 3 a.m., watching the dark streets, we hacked away at the bronze nose of Alexander Baranov, who fought the Tlingit, sent a fortune in otter pelts home to Russia. He was no worse than many others. But sometimes tributes to dead heroes need a little editing. Take Juan de Oñate, who brought the crucifix to New Mexico in 1580 and in its name ordered the right foot of every rebellious Acoma cut off. We corrected his bronze replica on his anniversary. Now his right spur no longer gores the horse's flank, a necessary correction to this very public record. In Scotland, the Duke of Sutherland, atop an obelisk, surveys the highlands, which in life he cleared of men and women, homes and families, in order to raise sheep. His monument, erected by involuntary subscription, a shilling from every household. Descendants of evicted farmers can't make up their minds to bring him down. The lonely figure's handy for navigation. Who owns the view, after all? And who owns history, if not those who survive? 1966, Nelson's Pillar blown to smithereens in Dublin. Not a soul was hurt, but the streets weren't empty 3 days later when the army cleaned up the shards and a few thousand people sang A Nation Once Again. Maybe history's in the freedom to pitch the bastards out.
Did you base Felix on someone you knew, or did he come out of your travels in Ireland?
Yeah, he's partly... all of the characters are fictive. They're all works of the imagination, not based on people I know. But some things about him do come from traveling in Ireland. One thing, the way Felix has... he's a calm young man, but he has some nervous gestures. He touches his mouth while he's talking, and his hand is on his lips. And you don't see men doing that a lot in America. You see women doing it, but I noticed men doing that in Ireland, and I thought, how interesting, a certain shyness, a certain...
Hesitancy
here. And so that was one thing, yeah. And the idea of traveling and being a poet, just it became kind of natural. I started to build a Felix file, and it kind of came together.
That's great. This idea that this alternative newspaper is struggling financially, Fairbanks is not that large. I could see how it would be difficult to even support one newspaper. Do you feel like there's a definite need for something like this, alternative point of view? I mean, we're lucky here in Portland.
Mm-hmm.
We have KABU, and
yes,
we have several alternative newspapers.
Oh, absolutely, there's a need. And there was maybe alternative is not the right term for me to use, because why should one newspaper be the mainstream and the other the alternative? But a second newspaper, a second media, there's a great need for that. How do you keep a dialogue going, especially when the main newspaper wants to set the standard, wants to set the record? And there was a second newspaper in Fairbanks the first 90 years or so of the town's history. And it just became increasingly impossible to hold together in the traditional newspaper format. Nowadays you have a lot of shoppers and inside the shopper you have some opinion and so on. But it didn't evolve that way. It just tried to remain a traditional newspaper, and it couldn't hold together. That was a great loss. I think there has to be a dialogue, otherwise, you know, and there has to be that kind of stimulation and irritation of each other and struggle to listen to each other if you're really going to get the story out.
Well, it seems like Alaska is kind of front and center in a lot of ecological issues right now, mm-hmm. especially with the drilling in the Arctic Wildlife Refuge. But from what you're saying, it sounds like people in Alaska are not getting any sort of viewpoint except for kind of the official line. Would you say that that's true?
Oh, no, because we get plenty of other sources from, just like in Portland, you know, we have access to the internet. In Fairbanks, for instance, there's the flagship campus of the University of Alaska. So Fairbanks, although a fairly small city, has two very good libraries. That's pretty good. And people, because of the university, people do travel a lot. They have access to other forms of information. So, but for local comment, for creating the record of Alaska itself, that's the tricky part. We have access to information about things happening elsewhere, like global warming.
The rest of the world.
But
yeah.
Creating the record for our community, that's difficult. That's different.
Yeah.
The boreal forest where this story takes place is a very special ecology, and yet Alaska's chunk of it is actually shared with, you know, it's a circumpolar belt, Canada, Scandinavia, Siberia. So what happens in those places is relevant to what's happening in Alaska as well. There should be a global awareness, and that's good. We're getting some of that. But what about what's happening locally or in Alaska, above the Alaska Range? That record, it would be better for that record if there was another source of news, a second source.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. There is a newspaper called the Tundra Times, and there are newspapers in other towns, but you need investigative reporters to get the story out there.
Right, and
yeah,
that costs
yeah.
money.
It's a heroic and thankless job. I know that.
We've been talking to Marjorie Kowalski-Cole. Her debut novel, Correcting the Landscape, is out in bookstores now. And thank you for coming to KABU.
Thank you, Marianne.
And coming up at 10:30, it'll be the KABU Report. For January, we'll be discussing such topics as Cascade African Film Festival, the Venezuela Youth and Community Radio Movement, and Clandestine Radio, a creepy story about U.S. propaganda. That's coming up at 10:30. KABU Reports is about your community radio station, KBOO 90.7 FM, and about community media in the world. This month you will hear youth voices from the Venezuelan community radio movement, produced by Robinette Jones. And a very creepy story titled Clandestine Radio, produced by Devin. But first, here's Eduardo de Landeros Tierre and Carlos Chavez about the African Film Festival coming up in Portland, Oregon.
African filmmakers are reclaiming their own artistic vision and are making the break on how the West forcibly denied them. Feature and documentary films through the eyes of Africans themselves will be presented by the 16th annual PCC African Film Festival. So February 3rd will open Portland Community College's African Film Festival spanning from February 3rd through March 4th. The festival takes place at Portland Community College's Cascade Campus in the Moriarty Arts and Humanities Building on the corner of Killingsworth and Albina. The entire festival will be free and co-sponsored by KBOO Community Radio 90.7 FM.
The feature and documentary films will represent African concerns that are political, historical, and social. This year's films, themes, and topics include the African legacy in Mexico, war and peace, the quest for freedom and justice, HIV and AIDS, the consequences of globalization as seen from the shores of Lake Victoria, love across class lines, the importance of preserving Africa's artistic and cultural heritage, and women's ongoing struggle for equality and independence. The film festival started in 1991 by four PCC faculty members, Linda Elegant, Mary Holmstrom, Michael Dembrow, and Joseph Smith Buani. Michael Dembrow teaches film and literature classes at PCC.
First of all, we want to open people's eyes to different parts of the world, to issues, ideas, cultures that they would not otherwise have been familiar with.
Mary Holmstrom teaches African literature at PCC.
I'm also one of the four founders of the Cascade Festival of African Films back in 1991. I was born in South Africa, but left with my family when I was 10 years old. And we moved to the U.S., and I've always retained a great passion and interest in Africa, and taught African literature at PCC Cascade for 12 years.
The opening night gala will introduce the internationally acclaimed film The Hero from Angola, directed by Zeze Gamboa. This is the director's first film, which will screen on Friday, February 3rd, starting at 5 p.m. There will also be a screening of the film Hot Chili, from Botswana on Saturday, February 18th at 7:30 p.m., the film producers will attend the screening. The festival will also feature director Sarah Rashad, who will bring in other African women directors as part of a Women's Filmmakers Week. She will discuss her film Friday, March 3rd.
February 11th, from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., there will be a symposium that features two films by director Rafael Robayar Corona, The Forgotten Root, and From Florida to Coahuila. The keynote speaker will be Dr. Maria Elisa Velasquez, editor of the Mexican African study called Cultural Populations and African Origins in Mexico, done for the Mexican National Institute of Anthropology and History. Mary Holmstrom.
These are films by film director Rafael Rebola Corona. He's made a trilogy of Afro-Mexican films, And the first one we're going to show is called The Forgotten Root. He is emphasizing that there is a third root to the makeup of Mexico's people, and that is the African root. Often it's overlooked, ignored, forgotten, whereas the Spanish and the Native American Indian root is. He has uncovered a lot of history regarding the arrival in Mexico of Africans as runaway slaves, as slaves, what they have contributed to Mexico itself, to Mexican culture.
The theme of the symposium will be on the African identity in Mexico. The presence of the African in Mexico has been a profound influence to the culture. The Mexican culture has, since the arrival of the Africans, denied or repressed the identity of this Mexican root.
Gitanitos y morenos son los haces del compás. Y en la sangre de sus venas late un pulso ancestral. Ahora viene este cantante forastero del sabor, que se mira en el espejo del sentir multicolor. Ahora vengo yo a cantar sereno. Ahora vengo yo con sabor a un...
This is PCC's free 16th annual African Film Festival, co-sponsored by KBOO Community Radio. It takes place at Portland Community College Cascade Campus in the Moriarty Arts and Humanities Building, located at the corner of Killingsworth and Albina, from February 3rd through March 4th.
Pintor que pintas con amor, porque desprecias mi color. Así tú sabes que en el fondo yo también.
Since the democratic election of Hugo Chavez Frias in 1998, Venezuela has come to dominate national and international headlines. Protests, referendums, coups d'etats, and calls for Chavez's assassination flood our airwaves, newspapers, and televisions. With this comes an abundance of conflicting and confusing analysis. So just what exactly is happening in this oil-rich nation?
Venezuela is living a new revolution which included the education programs called Misión Simoncito, Misión Robinson, Misión Rivas, and Misión Sucre. These missions aspire for social integration and equality.
For Cable Report's Spotlight on Global Media, we turn our attention and our ears to the voices of Venezuela.
Good morning. Okay, the principal advantage that I have observed is that in the mission they have gotten rid of the exclusions and it's gotten rid of the paradigm. Not only people with enough money to study can enter into the system of education. We are opening the way so that these people can study and continue with the profession, which will help them to develop themselves as people and citizens and to maintain a family. Thank you.
In August 2005, Venezuela hosted the 16th annual World Festival of Youth and Students. This is a space where youth gather to exchange ideas and share experiences of the struggles against war, privatization, corporate globalization, and the destruction of our environment. Inspired by the radical changes underway in Venezuela, participants Josh Wilson, James Sugid, and Gabby Wolkenberg stayed long after the festival to explore ways in which they could support and defend the Bolivarian Revolution. With the assistance of a few Venezuelan youth activists, they now teach English to students participating in Misión Sucre.
There is a real understanding within our class that the message about the process going on in Venezuela is completely distorted in the foreign press. And so this radio program was a way for them to think about what is it that we can say, what can we tell the world about our experience of the change that's going on.
And it's not like everyone has the same thing to say. This is not a homogenous community. There's a very strong and I think healthy dialogue about how this revolution should proceed.
These differing opinions within Venezuela of what's going on here are not heard internationally. No one knows what different Venezuelans think about their own process.
Hello, friends from the United States and Australia. Thanks for listening to our program. We are a Venezuelan group of students that today we have the pleasure to talk about education.
Missions are the cornerstone of Venezuela's Bolivarian Revolution. Misiones are social programs aimed at eradicating poverty, illiteracy, and providing access to quality health care. They are administered by neighborhood committees, also known as Bolivarian circles, and are funded by Venezuela's petrodollars. Misión Barrio Adentro, the first and most successful mission, brings free health care to the poorest members of society. Misión Robinson offers free education for the illiterate, while Misión Sucre and Rivas provides high school and university students free access to other educational opportunities.
Article 102 of the Bolivarian Constitution of Venezuela. Education is a human right and a fundamental social duty. It is democratic, free of charge, and obligatory. The state assumes responsibility for it as an irrevocable function of the greatest interest at the service of society.
Who we are today? We are participants of the Mission Sucre, who for years were excluded from the higher education system. Thanks to the Presidente, who on the 9th September 2003 gave us the opportunity for all betterment and the betterment of our country.
Since 2002, radio activists across Venezuela have fought hard to gain control over the information reaching their communities. Utilizing Misión Sucre as a vehicle to access international media is just one example of how Venezuelan youth and adults alike are participating in their democratic revolution. Some of the students featured in this program were Levis Uzcategui, a student of forest engineering, Jorgina Castro, a biology student with desires to study medicine in Cuba, and Lorena Luran. In March, the students and their instructors will be guests on KBOO's Buscando America. Stay tuned.
Convirtió heartland of America, this is Global Crisis Watch.
Taking you to the front line on the war of ideas, with people who are fighting tyranny and terrorism with the pulse of freedom. From the Twin Cities, I am Richard Lafayette.
And from inside the Washington Beltway, I'm Nick Grace.
This is Global Crisis Watch.
After 13 months of silence, a message from Osama bin Laden, the world's most wanted man.
Activists across Venezuela have fought hard to gain control over the information reaching their communities. Utilizing Misión Sucre as a vehicle to access international media is just one example of how Venezuelan youth and adults alike are participating in their democratic revolution. Some of the students featured in this program were Levis Uzcategui, a student of forest engineering, Jorgina Castro, a biology student with desires to study medicine in Cuba, and Lorena Luran. In March, the students and their instructors will be guests on KBOO's Buscando America. Stay tuned.
Yeah.
land of America, this is Global Crisis Watch.
Taking you to the front line on the war of ideas, with people who are fighting tyranny and terrorism with the pulse of freedom. From the Twin Cities, I am Richard Lafayette.
And from inside the Washington Beltway, I'm Nick Grace.
This is Global Crisis Watch.
After 13 months of silence, a message from Osama bin Laden, the world's most wanted man. The delay in carrying out bombing operations in America, he said, was not because of the difficulty of bypassing your security measures. The operations are being prepared, and you will witness them on your own territory as soon as their planning is completed, God willing. But now his latest message also offers the West a conditional truce.
The first time I went to clandestinradio.com, I was given the impression it was an independent media outlet.
Foggy Bottom, take notice of the mess in Venezuela. Take notice of Morales' embrace with the Comandante in Havana. The anti-imperialist revolution that emanates from Cuba and Caracas is spreading. How much longer can it be tolerated until it directly affects our national security?
After doing some digging, I soon discovered it was no more than a government-run propaganda machine.
Now, the worrying aspect of all this is that to the unlearned observer, these would seem like a spontaneous shift to the left by people in Latin America. But it's nothing of the fact. It is actually a very well-orchestrated, very well-planned strategy of using democratic means and democratic tools by these people to reach power, and once in power, to utterly corrupt and transform all the institutional framework of every given country in order to reach whatever their goals they set out to reach in the first place.
Furthermore, I discovered that the website claims to be nonpartisan and an international project not swayed by any outside organizations.
وحتما ستعود إلى أصلها وزعمائها الوطنيين الأحرار واللقاء قريب بعون الله تعالى وتبارك شأنه شمس الحرية تشرق من جديد في سماء سورية حرة عربية.
Turns out they were telling the truth about the international part. In fact, turns out there's a large number of radio stations that are funded by the U.S. government that translate this radio program all across Europe, Asia, and the Middle East. To make things even more creepy, there's a radio station that plays a speech done by President Bush, played daily, that sounds a lot like a Hitler monologue.
I'm pleased to send warm greetings to the people of Iran and to welcome you to the new Radio Farda broadcast. Yet the Iranian people tell us that more broadcasting is needed, because the unelected few who control the Iranian government continue to place severe restrictions on access to uncensored information. The people of Iran want to build a freer, more prosperous country for their children, and live in a country that is a full partner in the international community. My thoughts and prayers are with the Iranian people, particularly the families of the many Iranians who are in prison today for daring to express their hopes and dreams for a better future. We continue to stand with the people of Iran in your quest for freedom, prosperity, honest and effective government, judicial due process, and the rule of law.
ما همچنان در کوشش مردم ایران برای آزادی، رفاه و دادگاه.
It continues like that for another hour and a half. My advice to you is if you ever hear any media organization source or information from clandestineradio.com, such as OPB, NPR, and the BBC, do not trust that information. It is most definitely propaganda.
Well, with the recent calls for Italy, which is a major ally for the United States in the war on terror, especially in the Middle East, in Iraq, and with the Olympics coming up as well as a parliamentary election as well in Italy, should Italy be on the alarm for an attack?
European countries in general must be alert, certainly Italy, France, Holland, Belgium, Spain. All these countries, including the UK, are quite vulnerable because we are seeing that about 350 to 450 European jihadists have traveled to Iraq. They are coming back with experience. Not only that, the propaganda from Iraq is radicalizing a number of Muslim pockets, migrant pockets in Europe. So Europe today faces a much graver threat from a terrorist attack in the United States.
Rohan Gunaratna, International Center for Political Violence and Terrorism Research. Bin Laden is alive. This is Global Crisis Watch.
To the KABU Report on KBOO Portland. Coming up next will be Democracy Now! Earlier we announced a film review by Jay C. Meyer, and we're going to hear that review next Tuesday on the Radio Zine. Coming up next, stay tuned for Democracy Now!
Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! Broadcasting from San Francisco.
Out of Lebanon on Future TV.